Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the record fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score, which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History of Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires, Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Rare form today, Captain. Your football was, I gave it an attaboy. Outstanding. Nice job.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you. And before we get started, I got another piece of news I want to pass, although not overly pleasant, but I do need to talk about it real quick. Another longtime subscriber, original subscriber of Gridiron Greats Magazine, David Lawrence, passed away relatively young also. He was only 70. I haven't talked to Dave in several years. He also bought and sold sports memorabilia on the side, and sadly he passed away. I just found out about it this past week, so I'd like to express my condolences to the Lawrence family. He was a great guy. I enjoyed talking to him. I met him a couple times at the National. And Javi's, again, lost another great person. All right, moving on. Joe, I'm going to hand off to you. Let's look at some auctions that recently has closed. Go for it.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited, Captain. It's auction season. I think last show we were talking, you know, I was like, I love auction seasons. You know, whenever people are like, oh, there's too many auctions going off, I can't track it. I'm the opposite. I love auction season. We got four big ones firing off here in the next week. REA, Robert Edward Auctions. Obviously, Brian Dwyer has been on the show before. Ends this Sunday, December 6th. A massive amount of, obviously, REA puts their best foot forward. Love of the Game. subscriber, Gridiron Greats. Al Crisafulli's auction ended last week. Great auction. I had some consignments in there. Thank you, Al. Always exceeding my expectations and consignments. Mile High fires off next Thursday, a week from today, December 10th. Heritage has three auctions that are ending December 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th. And then Leland's on December 11th. So, I mean, if you include Heritage, in a 5-day span, four major auction houses firing off. REA, exactly. Mile High, Heritage, and
some amazing stuff in all of them. Incredible stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Incredible. Yeah, we were talking before the show. It's just it is unopened back because in REA is just a massive amount of unopened going all the way back to. They have, in the 70s, let me grab my my bid list and my watch list here. But, I mean, they've got some, 78, they have three unopened wax boxes of 78 cello, 81, a case, a factory sealed case of 81 rack packs, a factory sealed case of 82 rack packs. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1984 tops, the set that's dear to my heart, unopened wax boxes, 86, 2001, or 2000 Upper Deck SP, which has the Tom Brady rookie card in it, a wax pack box of that. Just incredible. And it's worth mentioning, since I've written an article in Gridiron about this, a bunch of high-end grade 48 leaf cards, but as I clicked on them, I'm just looking at how trimmed some of these are. It reminds me of just how sad this set has become. Just so many trimmed cards. What a great offer.
We've talked about the trimming on the 48 being slabbed for numerous times over the years, and it's just still so prevalent, and it's a shame. It really is, because you're not getting the real card. And, I've always said, I prefer my 48 and 49 leaf sets because they're basically from poor condition to, at the most, X. Nothing graded. And I tell a lot of people, when I was putting that set together back in the 80s, I never saw near mint cards from 48 and 49 leaf. So how, all of a sudden, in a 30-year period, did all these near mint cards come out of hiding? It's impossible. It truly is impossible.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. It's not a good situation.
It's sad. And literally, I'm looking at a PSA 7 Sid Luckman, that half the right border is missing, a PSA 9 Bulldog Turner, and this Bulldog Turner has made it around the hobby quite a few times, and it's the right border is missing. It stuns me. 10 years ago, my wife used to call it, catch and release. Because I'd buy all these raw cards, and then I'd measure them with these, digital calibers. Mm-hmm. I'd track them. So, I knew the dimensions of cards. Then I'd get graded ones, and I'd measure them in the case. So, I just had a spreadsheet of what measurements worked and what measurements didn't. And you just begin to get a feel for the set. It's tough to look at all of these high-end trim cards. Like I said, the Bulldog Turner PSA 9, it's just makes me shake my head.
And again, it was a situation, in my opinion, to say the least, that, no matter what you do to try to educate people, they're still mesmerized with the condition of the card. They're mesmerized by the slab, and they're buying it, and that's it. And there's no questions asked. That's it.
What's the old saying? The registry is a hell of a drug. But just some amazing auction firing off. I mean, REA, like I said, a bunch of unopened, some great sets. We move on to Heritage. Just a tremendous amount of unopened. 76 Topps football wax packs box with unopened in it. 1976. That's really cool. Another 2000 Upper Deck, one. It's just some great unopened mid-80s, 78, 79, 80. Mile High has some 86 and 78. It's just really cool to see. A couple Tom Brady rookie cards. It's kind of interesting, just Tom Brady stuff that's hitting the market, obviously. You know, he's getting it near the end of his career. Leland's has one open. They've got some good stuff.
It's interesting to me how back in the 80s, after the season was over, you couldn't give the wax boxes away. You know what I mean? And now all of a sudden, the value of them is just, you know, if I had the crystal ball, I would be at the compound in Palm Beach right now rather than the compound in Wallingford. That's Arkansas. You know, it's just amazing to me to see where all these prices went. I can remember going to shows in the early 80s. Dealers were willing to sell you a return box of Tops, whatever, for a nickel a pack, $1.80 a wax box. I still remember those days. And I always used to say, why don't you just break it open and get cards for inventory? And they say, well, I got 10,000 cards already. I don't need any more type of thing. It just amazes me, truly amazes me. So
yeah.
Evolution of the hobby, and I'm 40 years older than them, so it's much different today. So
yeah, I got a couple articles I'm working on for Gridiron. One of them is a comparison of unopened wax, like, you know, 84 or 81 wax. You know, so I'll take like 4 or 5 and then compare it to the S&P or the Dow Jones. See how people would have done if they would have invested in football cards. But you know, obviously there's winners and losers. If you would have sank your entire fortune in the, you know, 89 Tops, thinking that was, you know, that was the big one, then you know, you'd be poor right now. But
yeah. Well, again, 89, really the only wax box that still maintains value is the Score. Pro Set, you can I'm sure find for $5 a box somewhere. You can still find 89 Tops that are showing for $5 a box. There's really no value. And, you know, 90, forget, even though, Belichick is in the 91 Pro Set, not 90. 90 Pro Set, there's nothing. 90 Tops, there's nothing. 90 Score is even worse than the other two put together. So, you know, then they jump the 10 years to that Upper Deck Brady rookie wax box, and that's about all. All that's there, in my opinion.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yep. Yeah. We were talking before the show about something else. I was going through a lot of my old Gridiron greats. And one thing that's always confused me, I was joking around with you, is, you know, it goes by volume and issue. It's like volume mm-hmm. 7 or, you know, volume 6, issue 20. You know, we have no idea. I mean, what number? So you see a lot of people advertising in the back of Gridiron Greats, like, hey, I'm looking for, you know, for issues 1, 2, 3. But the problem is the issues don't really match what numerically, you know, what number it is. Because of the volume thing. So I was like, well, how do I correlate that? So I started tracking them, which is, you know, when you know, which is why I was able to find that article about you and Dan Goyich?
Dan Goyich, yep.
The Band-Aid card.
The traditional way of numbering was the volume is the year, and then because it's a quarterly publication, it's 4 issues in the year, and then you would do volume 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, then volume 2, number 5, so on and so forth. So I know we're on issue 70, and off the top of my head, I don't remember what volume. Well, I'm probably 17, and it's going to be 18. I got to pull it out. Volume 19, number 70, and then we'll be going into volume 20.
When did you take Gridiron over? It was in 2008, right?
issue 23, which was the winter issue of 2008.
2009.
So Frank Rose did issues 1 to 22. Issues 1, 2, 3, and 4 are beyond rare. And then there's some freeing up of issues 5 through 22. And then 23 up, with the exception. I'm actually getting low on some of the issues right now. The AFL, the World Football League issue, the issues with. You guys did, or John Spano did the Mayos. Those issues are
John and I wrote that. Yeah.
Yeah. are getting very, very low. So as I tell anybody, if you want to fill in your back issues, now's the time to do it. But, yeah, so we've been publishing for 11 years now. It's been a long time. So,
wow, yeah.
In fact, we're getting working on the December issue, which will come out January 10th, the winter issue. And I made a decision several years ago to mail it out after Christmas and New Year's because it's just crazy in the post office trying to get anything out, get anything on time. So it's just easier doing it that way. But so we're working on that now. And that's it. But getting back to the auctions again, it's pretty fascinating to see what's out there and how hot unopened wax continues to be. And there's in my opinion, there's no way in the future it's going to cool down at all. No way.
Well,
it's impossible.
Not a doubt. I mean, because if you're, you know, of a collecting age, you know, the most nostalgic thing you can think of is going to the, you know, going to the store, plopping down your nickel or your quarter and, you know, buying a wax pack and opening it. I mean, so, you know, if we want to talk about what, you know, what takes us back in time, you know, it's the wax pack. So, I mean, you know, so you see a lot of collectors are doing it. But, you know, we've had Steve Hart, the owner of BBC, he, you know, on here, you know, and he was talking about just the process it takes to, you know, to authenticate, you know, boxes and, and, you know, and it, Steve's just one man, and he's the guy who does it all. So,
right,
yeah.
And you know, it's I found it interesting a while back. I know I mentioned it. I went to a local show that was outside here in Orange. I picked up a handful of things, and one of the things I picked up because I felt sorry for the dealer. He had a bunch of unopened junk wax there, which he ended up selling for $5 a box to me. So I bought a 91 Bowman, I think it's second series 90 Pro Set, and a 92 Skybox box for $15, $5 for each box. And I said to myself, I'm just going to just let it sit there. And if the National ever comes closer, I'll just bring it with me, and we'll use it as our junk opening. But, you know, how many hundreds of thousands of those boxes are out there for the junk wax box era. And
oh, man.
You know, it's crazy. And to pay 15 cents a pack, you know, to put it in perspective, less than 15 cents a pack for the cards is just crazy. Truly crazy.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
No, and,
unbelievable.
I mean, it's like land. There's not much more being made. I mean, you're not making it anymore, you know, except in, you know, in an RV, you know, in Pennsylvania where they're resealing stuff. But, I mean, hopefully the experts are, you know, hopefully the experts are catching up. I have faith in Steve Hart. So,
the one thing I'm finding amazing, too, is the real big run-up in unopened wax boxes for Fleer Team in Action, which, again, you couldn't give that stuff away the next season if you had it at a show. So the 77 through 88 Fleer Teams in Action wax boxes are red hot, and it's just it's nice to see because that to me was always an overlooked set of the 70s and 80s, which was a lot of fun to collect. And there were nice small sets. Had a fun insert with the sticker helmet or logo stickers, and it's pretty cool. Pretty cool, to say the least. Well, our guest is here. And I'd like to move on to that, and I'd like to introduce him at this time. I'd like to introduce our special guest, who's a Buffalo Bills fan since 1963, and he's been a collector of Buffalo Bills memorabilia since 1966. He's married with two grown-up daughters. He hails from Texas, Mr. Joe Burden. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Hello, Bob, Joe. Great to be here.
Hello, sir.
Hey, I just want to touch on one thing that Bob said about the 48-49 Leaf, never seeing mint ones at a show. When I was going to the shows in the 70s, T206s, now it's baseball, but you didn't see any in more than 4 or 5 condition then. And then all of a sudden we have all these 8s and 9s that are kind of small. So it's about the same thing as you were saying. We didn't see them in the 70s, and all of a sudden there was a glut of near-perfect cards.
I've heard many people say about the same thing, Joe. is, you know, yeah, you didn't see perfect. These PSA 8 cards were created, you know, not made.
Right.
So.
Yeah, they're a scarcity, a man-made scarcity, let's put it that way.
Well, I always say there was somebody who hoarded the Leaf warehouse when they shut down, kept all the cards. And then as the years went on, he put them into the market in various conditions. I'm being sarcastic when I say that, but, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, man. Yeah, you're not going to find them.
They're not there. They're just not there. If you saw my 48 Leaf high numbers in football, you would die. I mean, you would just die to see the condition. They're in horrible condition. If I have any of the high numbers in GVG, that's amazing. Most of mine are 40.
Yeah,
fair.
Bob, you know there's a whole card there, though, don't you?
Say that again. Oh yeah,
I said,
yeah,
you know. You know it's a whole card there in your condition. All of it's still there.
Yeah. 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 So it's to me, it's just amazing to see where do these cards come from. And when I see a Leaf high number in 7 or better, I just say forget it. It's that's bogus.
Yeah.
That's a bogus. I don't care what anybody says. But anyways, Joe, I'm going to lead off. I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to hand off to you. Tell us and tell our audience how you became a fan of the Buffalo Bills.
Well, my father was an avid football fan, and he was ecstatic when the Bills came to Buffalo in 1960. He bought season tickets in 1959 for $12.50. That included 3 preseason games and 6 home games in old War Memorial Stadium, the Rock Pile. So he started in 1960, and I started going with him in 1963 at the age of 7.
Wow.
We would go eat breakfast, walk to the stadium. If it snowed, we shoveled off our own seats and we watched the game from the end. Yep, that in those days that's what you did. He bought end zone seats because he said he liked to see the holes open up in the line, but I just think he was too cheap to get 50-yard line, so that's where we sat until the stadium closed down and they moved over to Rich Stadium.
Well, I'm not ashamed to say
that's part of the bill.
I'm not ashamed to say I've sat in the end zone numerous times because those were the only tickets I could afford. And believe me, right, they were up there. So I got a good sky view of things. So I hear where you're coming from on that.
That's funny, Joe. We used to have, my family had season tickets to the Seahawks, and we were like 30-yard line, third row. And I was always impressed that we were in third row, you know, how close to the action we were. But the problem was is when the game happened and the players on the bench, you know, stood up, you couldn't see anything, which was half the time there was somebody standing up. And I just began to realize, like, you know, if you talk to people later, I'm like, yeah, third row kind of sucked. You know, you kind of wanted to be up about 10 rows, you know, kind of funny. But, Joe, I got to know.
We were up about halfway, so we could see the whole game. We were in the open end of the baseball. It was where the box seats were for the baseball, you know, the down by the dugouts. And this is long before nets for extra points, so they'd all the guys would clamor underneath there. I always wanted to go down there, and he said, my father said, are you crazy? Those metal poles in between people bashing themselves for a dollar football doesn't make any sense. So, but, yeah, those are some great memories in that stadium. I didn't know any better. I thought football was like that all the time. So,
Joe, I think I've told you this before, but I first got introduced to you in about 2004, 2005, and it was you reached out to me. I was new to the hobby. You know, I was active on the, you know, the CU, the PSA chat boards, but, you know, collecting the Hall of Fame rookie card set. But a Mastro auction ended, and I mentioned that I bought a PSA 9 O.J. Simpson rookie card, and you PM'd me, and then we had about a 45, you know, 50-minute phone call, where you told me that, you know, shilling was happening. but I have a really fond memory of you're reaching out to a hobby newbie like me to just, you know, hey, you know, how was your price on that? Do you think, you know, and just introduce me to, you know, the underbelly of it, just, you know, open my eyes a little bit. I always appreciated that.
Oh yeah. I thought, it was just a rumor at that time that Maspro and all those, not more than a rumor, the rumblings were happening that, some of the prices that they were able to see the bidders. And I just wanted to just reach out to you. You know, you told me at the time, I remember you said you thought you played well under your max bid. So that was
yeah,
a good thing at the time.
Yeah.
I'm sure that OJ card has gone about 5-6 times what you paid for it in 2005.
Yeah. I'm trying to, yeah, it has. I'm a big fan of that 70s set. Is pretty good. But you've mentioned a few times, you know, Jack Kemp, you know, just, you know, one of your favorite players, but you've had a couple of experiences with him. Would you know, curious if you'd like to share that?
Yeah, obviously Jack Kemp was a $100 waiver wire pickup by the Bills from San Diego and brought Buffalo the only two championships they ever had. So it was a pretty good $100 that the Bills spent. My father was a charter member of the Buffalo Bills Booster Club from 59. So they would have their booster meetings and they'd bring in, you know, guest players, whoever it was at the time. And the first time I ever got a look at Jack Kemp, and now I'm 8, 7, 8, 9 years old, he reminded me of John F. Kennedy. I mean, he was tall,
yeah,
perfect hair, elegant speaker. I mean, this guy, obviously, you know, the Buffalo Bills quarterback. So years later, my mother was the vice president of the telephone union, and they would have fundraisers, luncheons for, you know, for the politics for him. And I got to meet him many times in those meetings and talk to him about, have conversation with him about the Bills days. And actually his son Jeff was just starting to play, which
mm-hmm.
was another NFL quarterback for a while. And Jack was a family friend for many years. Every year he would remember us and send Christmas cards to the family. So yeah, I found
wow.
memories meeting him. Obviously went on to be congressman and then vice presidential candidate, and passed away way too young. So yeah,
definitely.
He was one of my childhood idols in football, definitely.
Kemp to me was always he class act all the way. What a great guy, great player, great for our society. Gave back in so many different ways. Amazing, and that, you know, it's so cool that you had that opportunity to actually talk to him. To me, it's just great, truly great.
Yeah, many great. Times he sat down. Of course, he'd go around to everybody, but once he got to know that I was an avid football fan, we had brief conversations about it, and I always kidded him that he's the only quarterback that I knew that threw more interceptions than touchdowns, and everybody still liked him. So
that's great.
Mm.
Great guy. Class act. I could still picture a 65 tall boy card, too, with the Buffalo spread on top with the capital letters. That looks
yeah.
a good way. It's like a purple background. So cool. So neat, to say the least. And that leads me to asking you, you grew up during the American Football League time frame while the Bills won 2 American Football League championships during that time frame. And again, a lot of people don't remember the AFL, and they don't remember that time frame where the Bills were really a very, very good team, and they were very, very competitive. They won. Do you have any memories from that era? Any stories, memories that occurred during that time frame?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of them, actually. we had season tickets throughout the 60s, and of course we went on excursions to New York City every other year, and Cleveland or Pittsburgh if they played those. I remember the win over San Diego, the Mike Stratton hit on Keith Lincoln. The loss to Kansas City was a tough one. The loss to Kansas City in 65 for the chance to go to the first Super Bowl. Of course, the quarterback controversy always, LaMonica or Kemp. When Kemp had a bad game, the fans would chant, "We want LaMonica," before he was traded to the Raiders. I can remember the defenses that we had. My father always said that if they had had the Super Bowl in 63 or 64, he thought that Buffalo would have beat Green Bay with the defense we had, shutting out San Diego and beating them with just 7 points the next year. I can remember every starting player off the 64 defense, but I can't remember what I walked into a room for today, though. But, yeah, we had many, many good experiences in those years. And, of course, later in the 60s, there were some down years when we won one game, which was against the Super Bowl champion Jets, and had the right to draft O.J. Simpson that year. So,
wow.
The only game we picked off Namath five times to beat the Jets for our only win that year.
Yeah, that was amazing. And that was the highlight of the Jets winning seasons, because it's been 50 years that they've been in doldrums, to say the least. You know what I mean? So it's truly amazing if you think about it and go back. And again, we're pretty knowledgeable about the American Football League. Again, I grew up with it. Joe's learned a lot about it. We all have the mutual friend of Todd Tobias, who is Mr. AFL. And I do maintain the AFL held its own against the NFL during that time frame. There were very good players. There were very good teams.
Absolutely.
And, if the Super Bowl was starting in 1960, I'm sure it would have been 10 years of probably parity between the two leagues. So it's amazing. It's really amazing to think about it. And it's so cool. You lived it.
The innovation that happened in the AFL didn't happen until the NFL saw Kansas City and the motion. And, I mean, the Minnesota was just stumped with all the motion that Kansas City was doing. And, of course, that was innovated back into the NFL after that. And Namath beating the Colts made the league legitimate. So people say that maybe Joe doesn't belong to the Hall of Fame because of his stats, but he changed the league, and he deserves all the accolades that he gets.
Couldn't agree more.
And I got to watch it a couple times a year, so that was even more fun.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe, you mentioned a couple, Bills teams, winning championships and stuff, and I kind of wanted to, bring something. A couple shows ago, I was telling Bob that I was in a store once, and I saw a guy wearing a Seattle Seahawks 2005 NFC Champions, jacket, and I was like, oh, man. Don't wear a jacket bragging about being number two. And it brings up a point. Is it, are you good with making it to the show? If you make it to the Super Bowl and lose, you still made it to the Super Bowl. The Bills are the only team to make it to the Super Bowl four times in a row. Super Bowl 25, 26, 27, 28 in 1990, 91, 92, 93. Losing to the Giants in 1990. 20-19 with the famous Bills saying, wide right, which reminds me of, Ray Finkel, from Pet Detective, Scott Norwood's last second field goal. 1991, losing to the Redskins, 37-24. 92, the Cowboys, 52-17. That one wasn't quite as close. And then in 93, the Cowboys, 30-13. When you look back at going to the dance, four times in a row. That's got to be very prideful, even though you lost them. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, back in the 90s, I was here in Texas, so those two Super Bowl losses to Dallas, we won't talk about those right at the moment. it was no NFL package, so you're streaming the scores live underneath. You know, there was no Thursday night game and Sunday night. Yeah. You had one chance, you know, if you went on primetime on, you know, at 1 or 4 or Monday, you didn't see the game. So that made it tough. And then, of course, living through four Super Bowl losses. By the fifth year, everybody was tired of seeing the Bills, and they were just hoping they wouldn't go back again. At the time, it's tough, but, you know, when you look back on it, I mean, what great teams that they had. Hall of Famers.
Yeah.
Exciting, innovative offense. I went to Super Bowl 25 in Tampa. I was witness to the wide right, so that one was a little bit – it was my only Super Bowl appearance, and that's a long ride home after one of those. But, you know, it toughens you up. We had a game against Arizona a couple weeks ago, the Hail Murray. And after that game, after they completed that pass, I turned the TV off, and Miria said, aren't you, I lived through four Super Bowls. Nothing in sports could bother me now. So she didn't have to hide any of the sharp instruments in the house. It's like, it's just a game. Living here with the two Dallas losses was tough because, of course, you know, leading up to it, you're bragging that it's your team and we're going to win one this time, and then to have both games not very close. But, you know, over the years, thinking about them, it was a great run. It really was. That was a great football team, and if they would have maybe kicked that wide right, maybe would have went through, they might have won another one, so...
Do you think in the 1990 Super Bowl, the Scott Norwood, do you think New Kids on the Block being the halftime entertainment had a factor?
Yeah, definitely. You had to bring that up. Yeah. Of all the four Super Bowls, you had to bring up New Kids on the Block, because that's what I tell everybody. You know the halftime show I saw? I'm not saying. I'm not telling you.
Yeah. Who is your favorite New Kid on the Block, Joe? Is it Danny, or is it, you know, who is your favorite New Kid on the Block?
Joe Squires, for sure.
That's a trick question. There is no favorite. Okay. Anyway, back to our regular scheduled program. I just, you know, that was just a tangent. When I think of the Bills, I think of that. And it which sucks, because what a great team, you know, Thurman Thomas, you know, Kelly. It's tough.
Andre Reed
later. Andre Reed a little
Bennett,
later, yep.
Bruce Smith, yeah.
Bruce Smith, yep. A lot of Hall of Famers on there, you know. So obviously you're an avid collector. We see you on, you know, some chat rooms we belong to that we're all on, you know, vintage football collector, VFC. And what are the things that are near and dear to you? What are your top five things in your collection?
You know, all of them that I collect are dear to me. But I went back to my old childhood collecting habits. I dabbled with the registry and found out the registry is a powerful drug. And I went back to just raw sets from 1960 to 1970, Fleer Tops, Philly. You know, I can still page through those and recognize most of the names in there. A master set of the Jack Kemp, obviously. I mean, what kind of Jack Kemp fan would I have? Didn't have almost every Jack Kemp card. Namath collection from 66. 72, with the glaring omission of his 65 rookie. And of course all the Bills memorabilia that I
you know, kept or have gotten over the years. But just a love of the AFL and the 60 through 70 era that I grew up in. You know, everybody, you know, they go to high school and they go off to college or get married and they kind of leave all that stuff behind, and then later on we'd all pick it back up again. So there was some gap in years there. So I don't think I get back into it until some shows, maybe 88, 89, when that boom came. But, of course, now a pretty healthy collection of Josh Allen cards. That's dear to me right now. I guess whatever you're collecting now is always in the forefront.
Yeah. Kind of is.
The 60 to 69 era to me is always the one. To me, it's my most favorite because I grew up in that time frame. And as everybody knows, my first packs I opened were 65 Philly and 65 Tops. And the impression those 65 Tops make on you for your entire life, I never grow tired of that set. I just love that set. I love the size of those cards. I love, you know, the crispness of them, seeing the player. And at that time you read the back of the cards, you studied them, you memorized everything, and just some great memories of that time frame. So yep. I definitely concur
the time frame. 65 is unmatched. It's unmatched in any set, especially with that size. That color just pops.
Yeah. Yep.
But it's just amazing. The 1960 Fleer card is the Kemp rookie, isn't it?
Yes, 1960 Fleer.
Yeah.
I didn't start opening packs until 66, the year after. It was the TV tube year with the brown borders.
Yep.
My favorite set of all time, obviously, because of that. But 63 became a very favorite for me going back and collecting that set. It was a small set, 66 cards, I think, with checklist. Pretty easy to put together. That was a fun project, very fun project.
Yeah, the beautiful time frame for cards. Joe, I know you lived in Texas, have lived in Texas for a while, and especially during the Bills' glory years. Do you get any stories you can share with us about that time frame, especially from a Texas point of view, as far as the Bills and either their love-hate relationship down there?
It was awful hard to find Bills apparel down here. I don't know if the Texas, it's such a big Dallas cowboy, especially in the 90s.
Yeah.
It was 99% cowboy. Of course, whether they were true fans or bandwagon jumpers, everything around here had nothing but Dallas on it. So, it was a lonely time in Texas to be a Bills fan. But I didn't mind it a bit because I would never waver off the Bills. People ask, you know, how do you continue?
Yeah.
Once you've got your team and you're a loyal fan, you are never jumping off to somewhere else. It just wouldn't feel right.
Good on you. Yep, I agree. About the only time you sway from your team is if they move cities, if they sway from you.
Right, and there was a talk that John Bon Jovi was going to buy the Bills before the owners now, and he was going to move it to Toronto, and Buffalo was just not having any of it. It is a very loyal football. We didn't have Major League Baseball at the time, and we didn't have a major hockey team. I mean, we had a minor league hockey team, a minor league baseball. So when we got the Bills, that was Buffalo and still is today. It still is.
I
remember the push to build the stadium back then, too. I mean, they were talking dome and everything. Still have things that say, no more Stowe, football in the dome, and – you know, naming the stadium was going to be a thing. We wanted it to be Bob Kelso Stadium for the only American Football League player that died in the Vietnam War. And, of course, that was the first start of selling the rights to major corporations.
Yeah.
Rich Stadium. Rich was an ice cream and milk manufacturer in Buffalo. So, and now I guess there's talking again about, you know, trying to build another stadium. It's only been 50 years. It feels like yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was
exactly.
Stationed in Orlando, Florida, when I was in the Navy. I'm pretty sure I was only the only Seattle Seahawk fan in Orlando, you know, in the early 90s, pretty much opposite end of the country from Seattle is, you know, is Florida. So it was always funny to walk around in Seahawk gear. Primed, there's a question here. Goalpost Restaurant. So I always like to do my homework before a show.
I can fill you in on the goalpost. The goalpost.
Well, hang on. So I tried looking this up. You know, I'm like, because I like to do my homework on stuff. Obviously, I, you know, rattled off four Super Bowls. I didn't know New Kids on the Block played at halftime in 1990. I'm not sure if you remembered it. But,
oh, yeah.
You know, obviously, I looked that up. I'm not that good. But so I tried looking Goalpost Restaurant up in Buffalo, even in Dallas, where you live now. I couldn't find anything. So I wrote WTF next to Goalpost Restaurant after a couple notes. So I'm just going to prime the pump here. What's up with Goalpost Restaurant there, Joe?
Goalpost Restaurant was owned by Glenn Bass. He was a wide receiver for the Bills in the 60s. It was in Buffalo, and our family would eat there from time to time, and a lot of the players would come in to frequent it to help the restaurant get along. I do have a menu from that. I'll get to that in a minute. So, of course, being young, we'd go over there and say hi to the players and get autographs from them, and that's where I got my Goalpost Restaurant signed by Jack Kemp. So I have proof that there was a Goalpost Restaurant in a signed menu from Jack Kemp. We were standing in line, standing to get seated, and behind us was Ernie Worlick. Now, Ernie Worlick was a tight end for the Bills, and 6'4", 6'5", and I got to shake hands with Ernie Worlick, and his hands were as big as, I mean, imagine a 9-year-old being slipped into a catcher's mitt. That was me shaking hands with Ernie Worlick.
That's pretty cool.
But I will post a picture of the Goalpost Restaurant menu for you to show you that there really was one. And it has Glenn Bass catching a pass on the front of the menu just to so let everybody know it's a Bills related memorabilia.
Hmm. All right. No wonder
so
I couldn't find it.
That
is pretty cool.
I didn't know you were prepping these questions. I should have caught you with a few anyways, but go ahead.
the apprentice has become the master here, Mr. Brennan. love it. So,
Joe, back on. Go ahead, Joe Squares. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I have a couple funny, you know, a pseudo Joe quiz for Joe too. When you're done wrapping up there, Bob.
All right. Okay. All right. So I got one more point for Joe. Any suggestions for a beginning football card collector and football memorabilia collector?
Yeah. I mean, I tell everybody that starting out or collecting, I tell them the same thing. I tell them buy what you like. Buy the best that you can afford. Don't try to compete with anyone, the registries. And most important, enjoy the hunt, because that's the most fun of it, is finding the cards to fill in your holes or add to your collection, because it's always the next card that is the best card. So
Just enjoy it. It's just a hobby. Just go about it that way. Just enjoy the hobby of it.
Exactly.
That's the advice that I would give anybody that's in it for a long time or just starting off. Remember that it's just a hobby.
Very true.
A lot
of people forget that. They forget that. They think they're in battle again or whatever. It's just it's amazing to watch sometimes, to say the least. Joe, I'll hand off.
You know, great advice there, I dig that. That always resonates with me. I got that advice from a guy very early on. I'm not sure if you remember him from the boards, Mark Dubbins, but just gave me the same advice. Yeah, Mad. He went by Mad. He saw me buy a PSA 2 card. You know, he's like, "What the hell are you doing, dude? You have a really nice set. You know, don't buy that crap." And you know, he goes, "Just be patient." And it was just some of the best advice I got. So, all right, I have a couple little things as I was doing my homework. You know, as I think of teams, I oftentimes compare them to my Seahawk greats. So, a couple questions here. You know, just a pseudo joke quiz, nothing really official. So, just first thing that pops in your mind. Shout out the answer here, Mr. Brennan. O.J.
Okay.
Simpson, Hall of Fame running back or amazing actor?
yards in 12 games. Hall of
Huge.
Fame running back.
Hall of Fame running
That's
back.
True.
So, all right. Option two, Hall of Fame running back, mediocre murderer.
alleged.
Don't answer.
He didn't
alleged.
Do it.
Alleged for both.
He didn't do
don't,
it.
Don't answer that. Don't answer. Alleged, yeah. No, we always joke around. It's I'm an Oregon Duck fan. And the Huskies play the Ducks every year. And whenever the Huskies come to town, we always wear the shirt. You know, Ted Bundy was a Husky. So it's kind of funny.
I didn't know the West guys, Coast guys, were so morbid at times.
We go for the jugular,
Joe. Just East Coast guys just throw snowballs at Santa Claus. That's all.
Outstanding. We go for the jugular here, Joe. Yeah. All right. Better receiver, Andre Reed or Steve Largent?
I do wish to remain friends with you, so I'll have to say Steve Largent.
That is the correct answer.
Wow.
Well done, Joe. Nice job, too. I mean, Steve Largent, you know, had to deal with, a lot of those Raiders, you know, guys, who would just, punch you, I don't, there's no video of Andre Reed, getting teeth knocked out across the middle.
Taking your head off was a whole different era for receivers back then, that's for sure.
Yep. Andre Reed's pretty good too, but it's kind of funny. You know, I jotted down here kind of, OJ getting traded to the 49ers at some point, which has got to be tough. Because I remember in 2005 when Sean Alexander, was the reigning, MVP, of the NFL, one of the few times a running back has been an MVP. It's I have a cousin who's a huge football fan, and he's like, Seattle's got to trade that guy. I'm like, you don't trade the reigning MVP. What are you talking about? He goes, no. Running backs typically hit about, this many yards, this many years, and then they start to go downhill. He's like, Alexander has one, maybe 2 years left in him now. If they trade him right now, they could probably get one or two first round draft choices and maybe some other stuff. You got to lose that guy. Everybody's like, no way. And the next year, Alexander comes out and hurts himself, misses half the year. And the year after that, he's really hurt and he gets traded to the Redskins for like a 7th round draft choice. And I just remember shaking my head going, wow, running backs do take a pounding. And
I remember
I
remember when O.J. was with the Bills and his career was winding down, and I remember saying to myself, how will the Bills ever survive? Will they ever go on without O.J. Simpson?
Yep.
I mean, that's what you think at that time is this is the end of the Bills. I mean, it's over. They're, you know, the team's going to fold up when OJ goes. Well, I guess they kept on playing after that.
Yep, it happens. But yeah, it was just it had to be tough to see him traded out. You know, to see him traded to the 49ers, even though he'd been, you know, what, 7, 8, 9 years with the Bills. I mean, got your use out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even the thing about OJ and the Bills at that time, even if they were behind, they were still giving the ball to OJ. I mean, they weren't even trying to win the game anymore with Ferguson at quarterback. They just kept handing off. They'd be down 14-17 in the fourth quarter, and they just kept giving the ball to OJ. So, you know, at that point, you really wanted something more than just OJ left, OJ right, OJ middle punt. So it wasn't that hard to see him go and move in another direction.
All right. Mm. All right.
Okay. Yeah. What did he only played a couple of years in San Francisco before he retired. So.
Right. Yeah. It was unforgettable.
Well, Joe, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you for being on tonight and sharing some great stories about the Bills, especially Jack Kemp. And I'm sure we'll be talking down the road. And thanks for being on today.
Absolutely. And thank you guys for having me. It's been a blast.
Wow.
Had a lot of fun.
It's been great. Thank you.
Buffalo Bills super collector, fan, Joe Brennan, our guest tonight. Joe, I'm going to hand off to you. We're going to go into our two-minute warning and wrap up. What'd you pick up on tonight's show?
Classy. I have very fond memories. I can think back to where I was sitting when Joe Brennan called me to ask me about the Mastro shilling. And at the time, you know, the WeWag scandal was going on, the When It Was a Game, where people were grabbing cards and resealing them. So he brought that up to me too. And then had the class to email me the Joe Orlando depositions, you know, so I could read them over. It, you know, it's where I learned a lot about, you know, the grading process. But,
you know, I think it's just so important. Go ahead.
Go for it.
It's so important to have a mentor in the hobby. I've always said that, and
yeah.
there's just not enough of them.
Yeah. Just cool for him to take the time to call me and to ask me about, shilling and tell me about WeWag. It's reaching out to somebody. And I'd been collecting for about 5 years there, but really, you know, seriously, you know, for maybe three or, you know, four. So it was just, it was an eye opener. And I've always appreciated, you know, Mr. Brennan taking the time to give me a call and educate me. So, classy.
Great story. And again, like I said, mentoring is very important in any hobby. And I see it sometimes, and I'm happy to see it, but a lot of times I don't see it. And I wish it could be. So that's why I like our group VFC, because you see a lot of mentoring going on. You see a lot of helping younger guys in the hobby getting in and so on and so forth. So it's important, very important. All right, we're down to almost a minute and a half. Check out our website if you haven't, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. And if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, Joe,
what are you waiting for? Seriously.
Exactly.
If you're listening to this podcast and you're not a subscriber, what are you waiting for?
You know, I was telling Brenda the other night, I'm just so saddened by the amount of subscribers who passed away over the past couple of years. It's kind of shocking to me. It's just really, boy, life is quick. That's all I can say. So I really felt bad, and seeing Dave pass is wow. Man, I talked to him about
original
2 years
subscriber.
Ago.
Yeah, and is that an original subscriber from when you took it over, or original subscriber from, you know, going all the way back to Frank?
Say that last part again. You cut out.
Is that an original subscriber from you
when
you took over? An original subscriber?
No. From issue one. So he was one of the originals.
Wow.
Yeah. So
Tough to hear. All right, 30 seconds. We're almost out of time. GridironGreatsMagazine.com. We've got a real special show coming up next week, and we'll be posting that over the next week or so, and it's going to be a great show with some very strong hobby specialists who we all know and have talked to in the past. So, Joe, we'll wrap it up tonight. Thanks for listening. GridironGreatsMagazine.com. We'll see you next week.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network. Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.